Now, does someone have to tell you, Charlie, it's sleep time now?
It's in the book. We have an incredibly detailed schedule. And
thou shalt sleep now.
Yeah. So the flight plan, we called it, but it was basically a daily schedule, was a book about an inch and a half thick. And there's about 4 hours of time on each page. And across the top, you'd have a column for each crew member. And it would go minute by minute what we were doing all day long. It was that scripted so that we could be efficient. And, you know, there's pre-sleep activities for shutting things down and setting the heating and cooling and all of that for the evening and, you know, prepping things for the morning. But that was all lined up in the schedule.
Yeah, but you had to close the windows because, I mean, every 90 minutes you get a blast of sunlight.
That was part of it. We had window covers that would go up so that it was dark through the orbital cycles. And, you know, and then you'd even put, you know, those things you get in the airline where you put...
Earplugs
and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Well, now, I'm sure that somebody has done this. You can't tell me that somebody hasn't snuck a snort bottle on one of these
officially or
missions.
Unofficially?
Unofficially.
Only the Russians do that.
Only the Russians?
Oh, yeah.
You mean the Americans go up sober?
Yeah, of course.
Oh.
Now, the Russians have the, you know, the famous thing, in case of emergency, break glass, and there's the vodka
bottle. There's the vodka, yeah. I figured that somewhere along the line, some astronaut has had to have, like, had one of those little airliner bottles of booze on board.
Oh, sure. But they don't drink it because it's worth 20 times more when they bring it back.
Yeah.
This one's been in orbit.
It's been in orbit. It's space jack.
Hey,
you know?
Speaking of that,
yeah.
Have you ever heard of the moon trees?
No.
I didn't either until I accidentally stumbled across one on Google Maps. They took seeds up on one of the Apollo flights and
they
orbited.
Now I know what you're talking about. I have heard that, and they've distributed them around.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's one right in Center City, Philadelphia, and I went and found it. There's another one right at the Lockheed Martin plant in Valley Forge, which back then was GE Aerospace.
And at the bottom of the tree, it says, space dogs only.
No. Yeah, right. Wow. But now they've got what they call half-moon trees from those trees.
I'll be darned.
Crazy.
That's wild.
I never knew any of that.
Yep.
You guys at NASA, so creative.
We're always thinking ahead.
That's right. I got a question for you. This is a trivia question. Astronauts have nicknames. What was yours?
Well,
is it arable?
Most of us are in the military astronaut corps, the military members of the astronaut corps, would get our nicknames from our operational flying assignments, like I flew F-15s. And usually those names came because you made some goofy mistake. And like if you accidentally jettisoned an external tank, your name became Tank.
There you go.
But I was fortunate enough that I was getting by without, you know, exposing myself to a name I didn't want. So eventually they got tired of that and said, we got to give this guy a name. And since I speak French and I was in Germany flying F-15s, I was always the guy that was coordinating with the French Air Forces for exercises and stuff. So I became Clouseau.
Oh, that's good.
That is
Clouseau,
good.
That's
Clouseau.
Good. You know, there was the communications group on this field is known as the Green Gang, and there was one guy that was part of the Green Gang, and he flew up. And as he was taxiing over to the parking space, the plane ran out of fuel.
Oh.
Well, they heard about that, and they forevermore known as dry tanks.
There's a call sign right there. That's the way it usually works.
You see, that's why we do all this stuff, because the stories are just fantastic.
They are.
Yep.
That'll be the good thing about tonight with Mike and Joe. You know, Joe Engel flew X-15s just like Neil's Armstrong did.
Right.
It's a lot of nice connections in the stories, and... it turns out that Joe and Mike Collins flew together in an F-104, and
those
tell
are
stories
cool.
about that. And the stories are great.
Stories are everything.
Right. Yep.
It always seemed to me that you guys did so much fantastic research on high-altitude flight with the X-15,
mm-hmm.
and then you said, oh, forget that. We're just going to put a big freaking engine on it and shoot it.
Yep.
It's like, just throw all that research out the window, it seems.
It was the precursor to all that we learned for flying the space shuttle.
Yes.
And other vehicles like it, you know, starting with the X-1 even. But we transitioned to what we call lifting bodies.
Yep.
And, you know... You think of gliders as high lift to drag, high L over D vehicles. The shuttle is a low L over D vehicle by intention.
You mean flying brick?
Yes, flying brick, exactly. And so we had to learn how to fly those at the subsonic speeds. You know, the X-15 is out there at Mach 5-ish. But what do you do when you have to penetrate the atmosphere from Mach 25 coming back from space, and the temperatures are 2,000-plus degrees, and you're soaking that temperature for 30, 35, 40 minutes, potentially. So, a lot, unintuitively, you would think that fast things need to be really pointy, and it turns out that that's not what you want because of the heat. You have to make them very blunt, and so that was the birth of the lifting body vehicles that we flew at Edwards after the time of the X-15.
Well, the other thing is you want it to slow down.
And you want it to slow down, and you want to dissipate the heat more broadly over the surface, so you end up with this vehicle that is very low lift to drag, and so you have to fly it at very steep glide paths. And so that was all the kinds of things that we learned through that whole phase there.
The one thing that amazed me is that you waited to the absolute last second to put the wheels down. It's like, wouldn't you want to know they were down before you hit the ground?
So there were three hydraulic systems, each landing gear also had quadruply redundant pyrotechnic explosive deployment systems, and all of those functioned simultaneously.
Wow.
We didn't try it one way and then go to the backup. It was you hit the button for the gear down, and all the hydraulics and all the pyrotechnics are putting those gears down. And
it must have sounded like all hell was breaking loose.
Well, you can't hear it too much in the cockpit, really, but that's probably true.
Yeah. All sorts of G-shocks going through this airframe.
Yeah.
Re-entry in a shuttle vehicle, is that a bumpy ride, or is it fairly smooth?
It's very smooth. The only time you notice any kind of bumpiness is as you're coming through transonic, you know, Mach 2 through Mach 1-ish time frame. You're getting through the shockwave there.
Be a tremendous fireworks show out the windows, though.
It really is, and that depends on what time of day your re-entry is, but typically part of our re-entry is on the dark side of the planet, and if you're on the dark side of the planet up high where the Mach numbers are higher, you get one heck of a light show out the windows.
Interesting.
And the plasma trail is hundreds of miles long, and what you're doing is the heat of the shuttle, the friction of the re-entry against the atmosphere is actually ionizing, stripping electrons off of the molecules in the air, and that ionization is kind of like, you think about it, like microwaving the atmosphere. You're not burning it, you're microwaving it, right? And it causes this long contrail, hundreds of miles long, literally. And as you look at it through the overhead windows in the space shuttle, it's swirling in like a vortex back there, and it's bouncing around because of our wake, aerodynamic wake as well, that's playing with it. And so it's really something to look up through the core of it. But once the sun comes up, the brightness of the sun kind of overpowers the glow, and you can't see it as well.
Okay. Did you guys go through ionization blackout?
Not in my time in the shuttle, because we ended up getting satellites above that could get down through. And so the ionization blackout really was the inability to get a signal down. To the surface. But we could get up over the top of the vehicle, which was in the wake, the dead space wake of that plasma. We could get through that to satellites overhead. And so by the time my four missions came along in the 90s, we had satellites that pretty much covered the full circumference of the Earth. So we had pretty much continuous communication.
That's good.
How was the food aboard the space shuttle?
It's better than Tang was.
Oh, my God. That's funny.
It got really good, actually. The science of how they prepare and preserve foods has really come a long way, and we do a couple of different techniques. One is to dehydrate the food. So you think of take a bowl of cereal with milk in it, and you freeze-dry it. You take put it into plastic and
pull all shrink the water wrap,
and
of
you
it.
Just vacuum it out and get all the moisture out of it. Now it looks like this foamy, crumbly thing in shrink wrap.
Yeah.
But there's a nipple on the edge of it where you can re-inject water, and you stick the water in there, and it just kind of swells back up and comes back to life, and you peel open the shrink wrap, and you have a nice bowl of cereal. You do that with shrimp cocktail. You do that with scrambled eggs, vegetables, all kinds of stuff. And it works really well, and the flavor is there still, and it's not bad. The other thing we do is irradiate, like beef. Or chicken or whatever, you irradiate you've heard that. And that works really well too. And if it's a warmed food, like steak would be, it comes in a cellophane or a tin foil kind of pouch, and before you open it, you just put it in the convection oven we have, and you'd heat it up, and then you peel it open and have a piece of steak.
Please tell me you had pizza up there.
Occasionally there would be stuff like that, yeah.
Not
so
bad.
We have on the space shuttle, you have the benefit of just lifting off. You can have some fresh foods in a locker that have to be eaten in the first couple of days because of the nature of food spoiling, obviously. But we would be able, with the clearance of the nutritionist there, get on the menu for the first couple of days. Some things like my wife would make chocolate fudge that we so like to have.
Oh, yeah.
Fresh chocolate fudge with walnuts, and we'd all share that with the crew. We docked on my last three flights. They were all docking missions, and we would dock at about 42 hours into the mission, which gave us a couple of sleep nights beforehand, but we'd still be eating the fudge while we're doing our rendezvous.
There you go. It's like solid coffee.
Exactly.